Hello, welcome to The Lore You Know, a show where we chat with some amazing human beings who are storytellers, collectors, and folklorists as we discuss the history of, inspiration behind, and importance of recording and sharing regional tales. And today, I have with me artist Easton Hawk. Hello!
Hello!
Thank you so much for coming!
Thanks for having me on. I was really wondering, when am I going to get a call? When am I going to get to be one-on-one with Heather?
Yeah, so, see, you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Watching this all of my contemporaries just come on the show. Here I am, just watching them, listening to them.
Yeah, the thing is that we go in order of seniority, and since you're the resident youth.
Okay, I got you. That makes sense. Thinking about the last few, that makes sense. Okay.
yeah, exactly. So this is the way that this whole conversation is going to go for listeners and watchers, because this is how Easton and I banter back and forth. He is extremely youthful, much younger than I am, and that's the way that this works.
It doesn't look it.
It doesn't look it, but it's true. Yeah. Thank you.
When I was living in Cincinnati, I grew my beard out specifically so I could just go into bars and watch hockey games and play pool without getting carded.
Oh, really?
Never stopped, yeah. Nobody said anything.
They never even questioned it.
And I was straight edge. So it's not like I was at the bar or anything. So it was just,
right.
I was there to watch a sport that I barely care about and to play pool like I knew what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. So you're just there to just to ride the edge here.
Yeah, just hanging out.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, so anyway, bringing it back to a little we have you on here. You have done some amazing art for STM. If you could do a brief introduction into like what you create, and specifically maybe why do you center on monsters for your art?
For the monster portion, I've always loved stories of monsters, movies about monsters, books of monsters. Just I've always just loved the, I don't know how to say this. I like how iconic monsters in like pop culture are. So if you do a cool design like Giger with the Xenomorph, like it is like a, you know, it's just an iconic thing. Everybody knows what that's associated with. It's a really, when you have an original like design and concept like that, just how timeless it becomes and how just terrifying it still is, you know, 40 years removed. So just, I would say that definitely movies are what pulled me in, along with like, you know, my grandfather telling me about Bigfoot around a campfire when I was probably six, when we were about to sleep in the backyard of his house with the wood surrounding us. So just, I don't know, just, I don't want to call it like just the power you get with like getting to tell monster stories. And like, if you're really good at telling stories, being able to bring images to somebody's mind, just, you know, I've always loved that. And then adjacent to that with movies, I love 70s, 60s, and 80s like movie posters. I love that whole heyday. I love hand-painted posters. So specifically with my work in cryptids, I wanted to take fun stories from the 50s, 60s, and 70s and make them into, you know, posters that you could believe were once outside of a movie theater back in those days.
Mm-hmm. What mediums do you work with whenever you're creating these pieces?
Nowadays, it's pretty much 80% digital and 20% traditional. I'm a dad and I don't get to make a mess like I used to. So the iPad in my backpack has been a very nice and convenient thing to rely on. And it also just helps me crank out work faster, but I don't crank out work fast at all. So, you know, I'm no Jonathan Dodd.
No. John Dodd does put stuff out really quickly.
All the time. Nonstop.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your average process then? Once you have an idea, you sketch things out, and how long does it normally take you to?
Oh man. I sketch things out on paper. Usually I'm really bad at doing compositions on a digital like format because the scale is so like so expansive. You can do whatever you want. So having the very small restrictions of like, you know, a 9x12 piece of paper or 11x17 piece of paper makes everything a lot easier to scale and just to get a rough concept out. And then sometimes I'll do just like black inks over the paper, and then scan it in and do all the colors digitally, or I'll just scan in the drawing, the pencil drawing, and then do all the inks and coloring and everything in post, essentially.
That's cool.
So it's still all hand drawn with iPad. I'm not good with Photoshop or Illustrator or any of that stuff. So I still like the ritual of, you know, holding an electronic utensil now and, you know, putting lines down in real time. But
How often are you doing stuff that like obviously you have commissions and stuff, but how often are you able to take the time to just draw for yourself? And does that art look different when it's just for you?
oh yeah. At this point, I take commissions very sparingly just because I don't want to stretch myself too thin, because I also have, you know, a regular full-time job and a family and just life. So I probably do like six commissions a year at this point. And I already forgot what the question was. I am so sorry. Aaron, cut that. Oh, my work looking different when I get to draw for myself. Okay. Aaron, cut it back in right here. So nothing happened right there. I remembered exactly what you asked me, and I didn't have to do a whole thing. So yeah, I only get to do a handful of commissions a year just because I'm trying to balance art with everything else. But when I do, I have allotted myself every single day, whether it's something that I'm carrying on with and just, you know, trying to like chip away at, or just for the sake of drawing something, I try to do 30 minutes every day at least. So, whether that's at night just sitting on the couch watching Roseanne and drawing, or, you know, like getting it, picking something back up and just chipping away at it. Because my full-on designs, they take about, I think the average has been like 24 to 27 hours when it's all said and done. So, and there was a time where I was able to like powerhouse through, and I would put in, you know, 3 or 4 hours a night on something. But now it's so few and far between just because it's winter and my circadian rhythm is dwindling, and I'm an old man, believe it or not, and I rise and fall with the sun pretty much right now. So I'm in a drought.
I understand. So
It's a
the I'm tired all the time. It's just it doesn't even matter when the sun's out, Easton. I'm exhausted at all times. So when you do art for yourself, then is this like the 30 minutes a day? I'm just trying to think of your process. Is it just you start drawing without something in mind, or do you sometimes have something in mind? Is it always monsters? Is it
most of the
humans? Is it
time I most of the time it's cryptids or monsters or some sort of something adjacent to that. I'm really interested in like sideshow freaks and like Weird Anatomy and all those like oddities books and stuff. So a lot of my like sketchbooks are mostly like Lobster Boy hands and like the Elephant Man and, you know, stuff like that. So just to like get my chops somewhat up, I just do a lot of like texture work, and it's nothing cohesive. It's not like a full piece. It's just very like an anatomical like study, stuff for myself. I love drawing monsters. That's pretty much all I can do. I hate doing portraits. I hate doing landscapes. So I'm glad that I found this niche where I'm okay with not, you know, doing a diverse array of things all the time.
How long have you been drawing, by the way? Do you have like sketchbooks from elementary school?
Oh yeah, I think I told the story on Strangeology a while ago. My lore is that when I was a kid, I refused to pick up my toys and clothes and blankets, and you know, I would just make a mess everywhere I went. And my parents gave me a hard ass ultimatum that if I don't like learn how to pick up after myself, I think I was 4 at this time, they were going to just start things away, like one by one as they find them, and they weren't bluffing. Uh-huh. So eventually I had a very small amount of things that I could actually play with, and they started giving me drawing pads and markers and pens, and I just started drawing. So I've been drawing consistently since I was four.
Which is about 10 years then.
Yeah, 10 right. Years you've been drawing. That's about 24 years.
Oh man, yeah, I've as a parent I have tried similar things with my children, not actually throwing their things away, but the threat of it whenever
they don't throw them away. They put them in trash bags and put them in the attic. But then I just
We put them in the garage.
So
right.
Yeah.
I put them in the garage. They also never got them back, but it never actually fixed the problem either.
Yeah. I'm dealing with it. So I'm not taking the that draconian of an approach with it, but they surely are going to get tired of me saying the same thing every single day eventually. Surely. Heather, surely.
You know, my oldest is 12 and I don't think she may be tired of it, but that doesn't necessarily change anything. She just gets tired of hearing it.
I've been telling people that I'm in the point of fatherhood where I think I am the like absolute shining perfect example of a human being in my household. And I'm just like, why can't everybody just be like me? Why can't people just do things the way I do it? So
How's that working?
Well, like I said, I've been watching Roseanne and drawing. So I'm in my full like Dan Connor era and everything is full. And everything needs to be fixed and done in real time or I'm going to lose it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what you're drawing to meditate so that you can. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to
have these moments of calm.
I'm trying to take some Todd Purse advice and just use drawing as a meditation. Yes. You could say that.
Yeah. There you go. So one thing that I've noticed with your art is sometimes you'll take like classical. I'm specifically thinking of the Fresno Nightcrawler here. Mm-hmm. You're taking classic cryptids that have a particular look and then you reimagine them. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that process a little bit, or maybe specifically about the Fresno Nightcrawler, but are there other cryptids that you have in mind to reimagine and change?
Yeah. So there's the train. I know we've done this
before. Yeah. Yeah. You live right below train tracks.
With the Fresno Nightcrawler specifically, I already brought up I love movies. I love special effects. I like to give things that are surreal a little bit more of like a biological, or you know, it's still pretty far-fetched that it's a big swarm of worms that are, you know, hive minding. But I just, after seeing so many Ghost Pants renditions, I wanted to do something that would like stick out a little bit. And I saw a whole thing about how in Australia, when the like rain season comes, worms will like clump together like that and form like essentially a baseball of worms so that they don't get spread out and, you know, drift apart during a flood. So I saw that and I thought that was awesome. So I had to take Nightcrawlers for the namesake and do it literal. So that's right. How that came about. But with most of my work, I've been pretty transparent about this. I am like 99.5% skeptic with everything.
Yeah.
I just love the human aspect of it, that it doesn't have to be anything more than that.
Right.
So first, I wanted to do a series of like the mechanics of like a hoax for each of these stories, like specifically Flatwoods Monster. I loved the proposed ideas of how this could be hoaxed with like kids, you know, stacked on top of each other, trench coat style.
Yeah.
So at first I wanted to do something like that, but that kind of sucks the fun out of it. So starting with the Nightcrawlers, I kind of wanted to just do a reimagined, like, you know, spooky, scary version of everything.
Right.
And I got a pretty good reaction. I didn't realize how many people don't like just like earthworms.
Well, I mean, I think it's the idea of when they're together like that. Yeah, and creating.
when they're
just one on the sidewalk after it rains, not a big deal. But
yeah, when they're in cahoots, that's bad. That's not.
That's
good.
Right. Yeah. What I mean, what is the story then? If they're together in the pants formation, why are they doing that? Well, self-preservation.
That's why I gave it that that like swirl open maw design also. So instead of it, being, it's usually two like, googly eyes whenever I see them drawn, but I like the idea of it being like an open, like, they could like pull you in type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really gotten down to the nitty gritty, like behind the scenes idea for that whole thing. I was working with a writer about making a small, like novella out of, he was inspired by that concept and he wrote like, at this point, I think it's like a 65-page, like Goosebumps, R.L. Stine type story to bring it to life. So we're still tossing that back and forth.
Do that.
Yeah, I know. We're thinking about it.
That sounds amazing. Would it involve then other ones as well, or is it all going to revolve around this?
That's
particular?
I kind of told him that I would love to do like an anthology type thing where. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be specifically cryptids and we can do like original stuff like that. But I am not a writer at all. I've been slowly trying to like tiptoe into, I have a little short story that I've been working on that I'm going to do some illustrations for. It's not cryptid related. It's very, very grim. Very.
It's okay.
Yeah. So I've been wanting to get more into like storytelling and illustrating, scary stories to tell in the dark style things where it has a nice, good, like 2-page spread of something ghastly. And then the story mm-hmm. Piece it together where you like get to the point where like, oh, that's the opening design or whatever.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. I'd like to eventually make it like an anthology if I can keep up with it and keep churning on it. So we've got a couple things. Like I said, we have the Google Drive of concepts and short stories and stuff. So it's just a matter of
that's really exciting.
Yeah. So I've been talking to Jamie Snell about doing like a big series of work beyond cryptids, but just like I want to have like a gallery type like show at some point adjacent to the cryptid stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be really awesome. And then speaking of the short stories, and you brought up scary stories to tell in the dark, that I think that's a great example of short stories don't have to be, they don't have to be expanded into like a novella, like the 65 page. Yeah. That's awesome if you can do that.
Right. Yeah.
But,
you can still get the story.
You can. Exactly. and then when you add the art with it, because that was also the iconic part of scary stories to tell in the dark, the art. It wasn't, the stories aren't actually that scary.
Yeah, just, dumbed down urban legends. So when it comes down to it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And some of them are just songs, kind of creepy songs, mm-hmm. but it's that art that sticks with you. And then it was ruined because they had renditions later where they used different art.
Yeah, also.
What's the point?
Yeah, exactly. Just do an 18th edition already.
Exactly.
We got to reboot and revamp everything now.
Oh man. So speaking of scary stories to tell in the dark, what are some other stories that you, or book series that you would check out whenever you were younger that kind of fell into this and helped inspire you?
Book series. I already brought up Goosebumps. That was like my big like motivation to start reading, to get those personal pan pizzas at Pizza Hut when I was a kid. I'm sitting pretty close by. I have the original 62 Goosebumps books that I still need to find a place to play. And I'm like, nice. And here's the horrible thing. I want to like pass them on to my kids, but I know they're just going to treat them like trash. And I like,
you got to do it when they're much older.
Well, I'm going to, the oldest is 9 and I'm about to like form like a library card like system where he checks out one of these books and he doesn't get another one until he brings me this book back in perfect condition. So
right.
We'll see. Maybe I can just start thrifting and finding duplicates, and I can build them their own little collection
Yeah.
of. But as a kid, Goosebumps for sure, but I wasn't as interested in like reading fiction when I was a kid. I was more interested in reading about like history or I've also brought up before that my big like dive into the paranormal unsolved mysteries world was the Reader's Digest Strange Stories and Amazing Facts book. I think there's an adjacent book to that, but it's like World Mysteries or something. But the Strange Stories and Amazing Facts book had like a blurb on Mothman, had a blurb on the Yeti, had a blurb on the Patterson-Gimlin film and Bigfoot. It had a blurb on like the headless ghost of Mince Westchester or whatever, someplace in the UK. So a lot of it had all of the like heavy hitter paranormal stories in it, along with like near-death experiences and angel sightings and exorcisms and all that kind of stuff. So I got really into that after I found it in my grandma's basement, and I realized that I liked it, and I tried to hunt for other things. My mom was a big late night cookies and milk TV watcher, so we would watch Forensic Files and Unsolved Mysteries and Is It Real on the, I think it was on the Travel Channel. So I was like in the golden age of like, TV's the babysitter. And so I was just consuming everything in that lane that I could find, all paranormal anything at that point. So as a series, Goosebumps was the only thing that I actually like kept up with. But other than that, I was just trying, like, anecdotal stories and, collections and something along those lines where I had some like factual data behind it.
What was your favorite Goosebumps book? Or do you, or favorites? Maybe one is too much to narrow down.
I would say my favorite book itself was probably it's probably Say Cheese and Die. I don't care for the cover that much because obviously when I was is what did it for me. My favorite cover was The Werewolf of Fever Swamp. I remember I would keep that in my backpack just to like look at it while I was like doodling on line paper during school. And then also the obviously the Haunted Mask. Think that it was like inspired by R.L. Stine having like an actual episode with one of his kids having a mask stuck. I love stuff like that. So yeah, I would say those are my top two. Neck.
What about horror movies? Like, did you watch a lot of horror growing up
Yeah.
or?
So what drew me into poster art and like realizing how important media and marketing like that is was the Thing cover that Drew Struzan did for John Carpenter's movie. We had a family video in town, and it was a Friday night ritual with my dad to just go to one of the two movie theater movie rental places, and I would find a reason to walk by that cover 1,000 times without him like trying not to see him, let him see me look, holding this R-rated movie that I obviously I know I'm not gonna be able to check out. But yeah, definitely that was what kicked it off. I finally got to watch it when I was probably around 10, just because it was on TV. I think I told this story not too long ago with Fire in the Sky. I was scrolling through, I was channel surfing and came across the abduction scene at the very end of Fire in the Sky. And I had to be like 8 years old, 7 years old. It absolutely terrified me. I switched it off after giving it like a good 5 minutes with flicker, because at that point at my grandma's house she still had like the dial TV set, and so my hand was on there the whole time, so if anybody walked in I could click it really fast. But I remember that scaring me and not knowing what that movie was froze forever. And I at one point when I was probably like 16, 17 thinking about it, I was like, maybe I just dreamed it up. Like, I don't know what that could possibly be. I never seen anything like that before. And then right. when I found down at like 22 watch Fire in the Sky intentionally, I got through that boring ass movie up until the last like 20 minutes. And that scene, that sequence started, and it clicked. And I was like, oh my God, I know exactly what this is now. So that was yeah. nice for me to have to read that.
So seeing that scene then, did that make it where of the, I always, when talking about the world of weird or whatever, mm-hmm. it seems like there's three camps. There's UFO, there's cryptids, there's paranormal.
Right.
Did that cause you to be more interested into UFOs or more terrified of UFOs as opposed to something like the paranormal or cryptids?
At that point, I don't think I even registered that was a UFO movie or like an alien abduction movie, because it's so bizarre right. with like the skin suit or like the skin blanket and the jelly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I thought it was, but I knew I was not supposed to be able to watch it. And I don't even think I made it to the point where you actually see like the heads of the aliens or anything. It was right. just, I just remember him like waking up and like floating through the ship and like dipping his head into like the hollowed out guts of another like abductee that event right. that I guess that's all I can like describe it as. But yeah, at that point I had no idea that was a UFO / abduction movie. So I don't know what.
So
I
it thought. Didn't ruin you. It didn't ruin you for well, particular.
It was
things.
Just like straight up body horror at that point.
Right.
I was UFO stuff. I already mentioned Unsolved Mysteries. The Men in Black specifically stuck really hard with me because I loved the movie Men in Black. Like as I think there's a photo of me at 3 dressed up as the Men in Black with a little neuralizer and everything. And I absolutely love that movie. Didn't realize it's based on actual, witness testimonies right. and descriptions. So when I got into that whole mythos, that scared me to the bone as well. Mm-hmm. But and then that led to my UFO era, I guess, my UFO like fascination, specifically yeah. because.
Your UFO era. I like that.
Nice. Still going. Still churning.
Still happening.
Still hot.
Well, so on Unsolved Mysteries then, you know, we had an awesome roundtable discussion on Jordan's podcast. That was a right. lot of fun talking about Unsolved Mysteries. Mm-hmm. And there was an abduction thing there that had gotten you. Right?
Yeah,
one of
yeah,
the stories
Allagash.
There.
Yeah, the Allagash abduction really did a doozy on me, just because one, just because of the imagery of the, like the dramatizations that they filmed for the show, but also the brothers in that abduction being artists and them drawing what they recollected from their hypnosis session was right. really, and of course back then I believed everything, so
sure.
Unsolved Mysteries is going to tell me about unsolved murders that they know happened. They're surely going to tell me about things that also surely happened.
Yeah, that's how that works. I can't believe you're questioning it now. What? When was the turning point to being more skeptic? Was there a particular story that you're like, all right, this is too much now?
No, there's not. I don't even think it was like a paranormal thing that kicked that off. I think it was just... coming of age, just having better judgment in things and having a more like realist view on the world and deciding that I wasn't like a religious person and it's pretty black and white when it comes to reality. So,
right.
I love the escapism of all of the stuff. Mm-hmm. But until something happens, I'm one of those classic, until it happens to me, I'm not going to like fully believe it.
Right.
The 0.5% that I left out is specifically for the Mothman story, just because of there had to be something weird going on with that many people, running amok.
Right. Right. Yeah. So Mothman's the one that you're leaving a little bit of leeway for.
Yeah. Specifically Mothman, because Mothman himself is fine. Like, he's cool. It's all of the premonitions and the Men in Black and the UFOs and the the number the telepathic voice just spouting off numbers and all of that kind of weird stuff, poltergeist activity.
Right. Oh man. I find that's entertaining to me. What about Mothman? Are you specifically Mothman in West Virginia, or are you willing to? Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, I like the Chicago Mothman stuff too, but specifically I love the Point Pleasant, you know, Appalachia story, because of how do I want to put this? I'm really into like cursed towns and cursed lands stories.
Yeah.
So, the Cornstalk curse and that whole that whole side plot really fascinated me, and like with that being a supposed factor in everything, I just love like the tie-in of everything, whether or not it's you know, not real, but I love the Scooby-Doo factor and all of that stuff.
What are some other cursed land stories that I can't trying to think?
So, well, specifically, I read Stephen King's It while I was in high school, and I finished the damn thing. I got through it.
Wow.
I read into most everything. I've read it a couple more times now. I love that, like, salt and pepper texturing that Stephen King did for Derry. Have you ever read the book?
I have not read the book, okay. No. No, I watched the movie when I was young, and it ruined me for clowns, so.
It's fine. In the book, there are, I think, five interludes every few chapters, and it's just like dark history and points in Derry that sparked Pennywise like coming back and taking kids. So there's like a black nightclub that burned in the 20s. There's a like Bonnie and Clyde style gang that the townsfolk like ambushed while they were driving through town. There's an ironworks building that exploded on an Easter Sunday while families were like outside of the factory, like doing an Easter egg hunt. There's just all these like really cool, like old timey, like you can hear an old, you know, an old man just like jawing about it in the park.
Right.
Like, what do you remember from being a boy? That kind of stuff. So I just love those kinds of like dark history, morbid history type things. IRL, there's Skidmore, Missouri, I want to say. Okay. Have you heard of the town No One Saw a Thing, that docuseries?
Yes, I watched
that. I loved, like, even beyond the Ken Rex Macklemore or whatever his name was. Beyond that, I loved the like way they tried to end that documentary with like, why is this town, you know, after they killed the bully, why isn't this town like a utopia? Like, everything is pretty rotten and dark and, you know, sinister. I love that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's one of those that I had, they were only premiering it on a particular streaming service. And so it was one of those times.
Showtime or Star or something like that. But yeah.
Yeah. It was one of those where I signed up for a week specific, or whatever for free.
Just did the same thing. So I think that whole fascination came from, so my hometown is Kokomo, Indiana. Indiana loves to name towns after much better places. Like, so there's Kokomo, Indiana. There's Peru, Indiana. There's Miami County. There's so many places named after better places. and I found out that the YMCA owned like summer campgrounds that I had gone to a few times. I found out that those grounds held the largest KKK rally in United States history back in the day. And now there are children skipping and shooting arrows and canoeing and et cetera, on this like dark spot of a like historical like area. So I think that's when I learned that, that like really kicked off my interest in more like shady, you know, hush hush history points that you know, people that have been around a long time know about because it's not recorded history, essentially.
Right, right. Is I'm not familiar with Kokomo. Is it a small town? Is it a decent sized city? Or
I think it was pretty small, but moving out of Kokomo and into a smaller town, Kokomo is actually pretty substantial. It's like it's about an hour north of Indianapolis, and it's about 2 hours from Fort Wayne. It's like smack dab right in the middle of the state. If I guess, there's probably like 200,000, 300,000 people.
Oh yeah, that's not a small town. What?
I could be way off.
It's just
I have no concept.
Yeah.
Of large amounts of people. I know than Indianapolis. It's smaller than Fort Wayne. It's smaller than Lafayette. Like stuff like that. So it could be 130,000 people, something like that.
Yeah. Still, that I was thinking of like the small town that I grew up in, which is just a few thousand people.
Okay.
For the whole town.
Nothing
like and that. Hearing stories, it was a similar thing when I got into high school. That a friend had been digging through her grandmother's attic and came across a newspaper that had a murder in it.
See?
And like a shooting from the 1920s or something. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, because stuff like that, it's one of those things where a small town, so normally things don't happen here, but when they do, it's a huge deal.
Right.
Yeah. But then to see something from the 20s, I'm like, what? This was, it was a gang thing?
Right. Like,
what? This stuff happened here?
Now, I live in Wabash, Indiana, which is, I'm not even going to try and throw out a number. It's a very small town compared to Kokomo. And I've been trying to like find those little crooks and crannies of like weird history. And I found I think five accounts that I would classify as weird or, you know, suspicious. They're quick. I can give you a house out by my in-laws. Entire family was murdered with an axe back in like the 80s, like not long
in ago. The 80s.
Yeah.
Wow.
A similar thing. My mother-in-law herself, she told me a story about when my wife was very young. She was home alone because my father-in-law is a workaholic and is a man of every trade. So he's just always, you know, bringing home the bacon.
Yeah. And
at night he was working overnight, and she heard what she thought were like animals fighting, or you know, something, because they live in a very dense like wooded area on top of a hill. But she could hear through the glass windows that there was something out there yelling or screeching or something. Come to find out, that was a woman also being hacked with an axe by her boyfriend in the middle of the night. And they, you know, the farmer found her like a day later, or maybe it was the next morning. So
wow.
That little nugget. My in-laws own a piece of property out in the country that has supposedly a phantom cow that will rise out of the ground on a specific night and then fall back into the ground after a time. So, and there's a newspaper clipping about this whole thing. So at one point, the phantom cow. And then lastly, there is a story about a guy who supposedly inherited a bunch of money and faked his own death. And that's like a gossip piece from like the 70s that people think that he like exploded his truck like down. And I don't know if there was like any body or anything left in the cinders or whatever, but just like he was gone. So he
hightailed it out of here.
Yeah, people rumored that maybe he just like went down to Florida or something.
Sure.
So there's plenty
that's
of fun,
a possibility.
Fun little things like that around here. I'm trying to find more.
Yeah, where is your rendition of the Phantom Cow, Easton?
I have to figure out how to convey that this cow is both a phantom and, you know, a temporary item. I don't know how to do that.
It could be more like That could be some of the body horror stuff, is it's just like melting up out of the ground.
Oh, there we go. Oh, okay. Yeah. If I have liberties, if I don't have to be accurate to the telling of the story, sure. Yeah, I could do anything.
Right. Exactly. You know, yeah. This is what I say, a reimagining, right? You could do it.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Do the boring phantom cow and then do the real.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Oh, man.
We're gonna get those tourist
dollars.
So we're gonna get those tourist dollars. We're gonna start the
family. That's right. Yeah. That's what you need is just a monster and then play it up.
I know.
It's how it works.
I'm
did you find some of those from like newspapers.com then or
Some were, so a couple of those word of mouth, just with Emma's parents. Yeah. And then there is a I think it's Wabash County Historian on like Facebook. They'll do like they'll post clippings and articles that were, you know, just archived.
Yeah.
So between those and then my wife being a funeral director and hearing a lot of secondhand stories from the old timers that just come down to the funeral home and jaw
with sure. Nothing, which I bet she gets lots of awesome stories.
Oh, you'd be actually pretty surprised at the caliber of people that just like come to hang out at the funeral home when nothing's happening. Not doing any business whatsoever. Just come down there to talk to the directors and, you know, waste time.
Oh, all right.
So, funeral actually has a like a free I don't know what to call it, like a party room essentially. So if you don't want to pay money to rent a celebrations place, you can go to the funeral home and rent their, you know, just have a space downstairs and people take them up on it.
Yeah, that would be a great time. Yeah. That would be, I mean, the themes that you could come up with to have
on Curb Your Enthusiasm. One of Larry David's friends has a living funeral where they do the entire procession of a funeral, except he's upstairs watching everybody do their eulogies from a TV and it goes horribly wrong, obviously. Yeah. But it's kind of tempting. It's tempting.
Oh, man. Okay, well, we have reached the end of the show, but what I always ask my guests are to tell me a story, which you just told me like 5 stories, which are amazing.
Oh, man.
But if you have other stories, maybe I'm thinking, what story really captivated you from the book that you dug out of your grandma's basement? What's one of the stories that caught you there that you could retell us here?
Oh, geez. I think one of the non like wholly paranormal stories that really caught my attention was, I'm blanking on it right now. Oh no, this is really bad for a podcast.
You're fine.
Oh no. Dyatlov Pass.
Oh yeah, that is Russia, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure it's Russia. Yeah, I remember Dyatlov Pass being a like very, very viscerally like scary story in my mind while I was reading it because of the obvious, you know, mutilated bodies and no cause for these people to run out barely clothed into the icy, you know, unforgiving winter. For that one being particularly scary. It wasn't, I mean, I'm sure there were anecdotes in there, but they don't stick out in my mind. But the near-death experiences really caught me. And I mean, at that point, I was going to a Christian, like a private Christian elementary school. So those affected me quite a bit, just from like, I'm already like very scared of going to hell because right. I have been told that that's what happens if you don't, you know, do things just yeah. right. Yeah. So the idea of a near-death experience and, you know, either way, either scenario, going to heaven or hell, and then coming back to your physical body terrified me. And still does, just like, you know, Glitch in the Matrix style stuff or, you know, Time Slip Cup type stuff. The Boys on the Tracks is still like one of my big ones that I'm genuinely like, I really want there to be some sort of like solid concrete, you know, closure to it mm-hmm. because it's a wild, like far reaching story. So we can go over that.
Okay, let's go over that one.
Just a quick one. Let's, are you familiar with that? I'm pretty sure we talked about it.
We did talk about it. We did talk about it briefly, but remind me.
It's the story of two boys that were out shining for deer, which is highly illegal and cruel. And the story goes that they were ran over by a train in the middle of the night. And come to find out, they were already dead before the train hit them. And forensically, they were just... They were probably there for a couple hours. They could tell by like the hue of their blood and like the viscosity right. of it. Stuff like that. And then from there, it's a lot of finger pointing and trying to figure out who did it. It's a story about a wildly incompetent medical examiner who said that they were high on 100 units of marijuana and just passed out on the tracks and didn't wake up with a roaring train barreling over them. But then there were a lot of witnesses that came up and said that the boys ran into a group of people that were out looking for a cache of drugs that were dropped into the woods via airplane. And those people included high-level, like, city government officials and cops and lawyers. And they were killed because, you know, they were at the wrong place at the wrong time type thing. But then it goes from that to the witnesses dying in strange ways, which the medical examiner also attributes to very far-fetched circumstances, like a man who had his head bitten off by a dog. It was clearly, but he died of a heart attack. But it was clear that it wasn't chewed off by a dog because it was found in a trap. And he was like, the dog just threw it up. He hacked it up. And then
how big is the dog?
I don't remember. It was like Rottweiler. So it's not far fetched. But come to find out, the medical examiner was the reason Bill Clinton's mother, who was an anesthesiologist, he was the reason that she didn't go to prison in a wrongful death suit. So there's a whole like political conspiracy at that point because Bill Clinton just gave this guy like, you know, raise after raise and promotion after promotion while he was governor in Arkansas. And plenty of murder and mayhem followed just these two kids being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's interesting. Wow.
So it could be anything. Anything could have happened.
Could just be that the town is cursed. Who's to say?
There you go. Oh my goodness.
I won't be offended whatsoever.
If we don't want to what?
If you don't want to air this episode and you just want to act like it just like never happened.
You just scrap it all.
That's completely, I won't blame you whatsoever.
What if that's what Jordan did with ours?
You know, I've thought about it. I've thought about it. So.
We wondered. We just haven't asked. Yeah.
I'm not gonna.
No. Yeah, it'll save us from hurt feelings.
I won't even acknowledge it ever happened, except for on this show.
That's right.
It never happened.
That's right. The only evidence is gone if this doesn't get posted. Anyway, well, thank you so much for coming. Can you tell listeners and viewers where to find you and follow you?
I primarily just lurk on Instagram at Easton Hawk Illustration and Reddit also, and my username is u/diaperfeast.
Okay.
Waiting. I wish.
Yeah.
It's a Tim and Eric bedtime stories reference. It's a
Okay.
good
All
show, I
right.
promise.
I don't know it, but I'll take your word for
I'll send
it.
you a copy. I'll
Okay.
find
Oh man. Well, this has been a blast. And we will absolutely post it. I don't we'll see. We'll see. We'll post it. No, I'm just kidding. It's happening. Yeah, well that's it for the show. Everybody, thanks for listening. You can email me Heather at smalltownmonsters.com. And yeah, until next time.
The Lore You Know is presented by the Small Town Monsters Broadcasting Network. You can find out more about this and other network shows, as well as Small Town Monsters films, books, our upcoming Kickstarter campaign, and much more at smalltownmonsters.com. If you enjoyed this show, consider giving it a like, rating, review, or sharing it with a friend. And be sure to tune in next time for another episode of The Lore You Know.